buckle up for an unfiltered dose of comedy.
Full disclosure, I've had a lot of sex, but honestly, having sex with me is like buying a Prius. It's much quieter than you'd expect.
Epics presents Unprotected Sex. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here, and I want to tell you about the Orange Tree. Now, I have recently started a podcast network called Audio Up, and much as I prepare for movie roles, I've been researching the podcast landscape and listening to hundreds of podcasts. One in particular stopped me in my tracks. The Orange Tree. It's a true crime podcast series told with such authenticity and care by Haley Butler and Tinu Thomas, two journalists who were University of Texas students when they started reporting on the story. It's about the 2005 murder of a young woman named Jennifer Cave near the University of Texas at Austin campus. What struck me most was the thorough examination of the case and the exclusive access granted to these two young reporters. What makes this true crime story so unique is their perspective. They're two young women who are the same age as Jennifer Cave and at very similar points in their lives. The Orange Tree is engaging, it's thoughtful, and really, really powerful. Take a listen to The Orange Tree on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts today.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. It's Scott Lips, and you are back for another action-packed episode of Lip Service. On today's show, Mr. Anthony Boza. Anthony is a super well-known journalist, written many cover stories from Rolling Stone, and obviously you know him for writing books like The Eminem Book, out now, books by Slash, Tommy Lee, Artie Lang, Mick Fleetwood, Tracy Morgan, AC/DC, Derek Jeter, the list goes on. Stories that this guy has are unbelievable. He also has his own podcast, which we're excited to hear about. We're both from Long Island, which is amazing. So if you like the show, make sure you tell 10 friends about it, tell 20 friends, tell as many friends as you can humanly, humanly possible. Hopefully the show is available everywhere for you, iTunes, Spotify, everywhere that you get your shows. And coming up in just a moment, Mr. Anthony Boza.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey guys, it's Scott Lips. Welcome to the show. Another exciting episode of Lip Service with today's guest, Mr. Anthony Boza. So I said it correctly?
Anthony Boza, yes.
Boza, right. I said it correctly because I know there's been some debate on how your name is said, but that is the correct pronunciation.
Mm-hmm. From the Italian.
From the Italian. Here. So it's funny. We were just talking and we have many connections in life, but first and foremost, we have a great friend, Sean Daly, who we can't, on tour, as I was saying, Sean and Miko, the guitar player we played with at the time, did a lot of picture taking of me sleeping on tour with my mouth open. So that was my fondest memory of my time traveling with Sean. But you're from Long Island.
It was my first exposure to you. And
was it? Yeah.
I'm happy to say that our relationship's gone nowhere but up.
Yeah. After you see tons of Instagrams of someone sleeping with their mouth open across every city in the country.
Yeah.
There really is only one place to go, which is up. But
it wasn't fair because you're a very like dapper put together
thank
guy.
Thank you. But
you're never really out there like that.
It was meant to show me at my worst, which they did a great job at. But you're actually, it's funny, in doing the research, and we'll talk about the fact that how many New York Times bestsellers are at this point are you?
Like eight.
Eight, okay.
Yes.
So you're actually the second author, Mr. Neil Strauss. My buddy was on the show too.
One of my peers and buds.
One of the greatest guys. And I have a guy named Jay Sheedy coming up too, who you might know, who's another nice author who used to be a monk, which is incredible.
Whoa.
But so you're my second author on the show and friend. And obviously, I want to talk about your beginnings, your path, Anthony, and how you started and whatnot, but we are both from Long Island, so which is great, you know.
Strong Island, baby.
And I didn't know that. And not only are we both from the same place, we're both from the same exact. My parents, shout out to my incredible mom and dad, live in a place called Port Washington, Roslyn.
Yeah,
which is, I guess, where you grew up.
Yep, Born in Brooklyn, raised on Long Island, Port Washington. We moved a couple times, but like, you know, I was right off Main Street down there. I love Port Washington. It's super cute.
Was it called the Manhasset,
the Americana?
The Americana,
yes.
Right.
We moved to Manhasset, and I was able to bike ride to the Americana.
Yeah, I would say like the mean streets of Manhasset, right? Because it's pretty affluent, I guess, right?
Now it's like Rodeo Drive.
Right.
It used to be a little more mixed. Like there was a grocery store. There was like an A&P in there back when I was a
kid. Not there anymore. Right? It's all like Gucci and Prada and whatnot.
Totally. Like when, you know, it's in that Billy Joel song, like, you got to get some white wall tires if you want to cruise the Miracle Mile.
Right.
So that was a little different back then.
That's definitely was not the case now. But so you grew up there, and you grew up in a pretty affluent. Your background was affluent. Your folks were great. What do your parents do?
My dad was retired, but he's a doctor.
A doctor, right? Because I heard on one thing that in researching you, he delivered, like, a guy who was doing a Guns N' Roses podcast with you, his baby.
He did.
Oh,
yeah,
he delivered him, actually.
Yep. He's an OBGYN.
Exactly.
And we have the same, you know, he named me after him. So there's been a couple of funny, you know, moments where he checked into a hotel once, and I think this is the only time he really realized I was doing something cool. And somebody was like, "Did you write that cover story on Rolling Stone this month?"
I did. He was in between delivering babies.
He's confused.
The M&M story, actually.
Exactly.
So many books. Obviously, I talked about, you know, the M&M book is new, came out. I did talk a little bit, and I want to talk about your history and how you got to being a writer and all that kind of stuff, but I do have to touch base on the fact that I did watch the Oscars. I think your phone, we all think the phone is definitely listening to us, because the first picture that came up on my Instagram a minute ago after I talked about this is something that I'll show you, because I thought it was quite fascinating, because you know how you talk and then something shows up on your phone a second later. And
everyone's listening. They're all listening.
Big Brother's watching, right? But interesting enough, when I just was on my Instagram a second ago, the first thing that came up after talking about in your intro was a picture of Eminem, and it said, "Eminem finally explained why the hell he was at the Oscars." Because I think we were all confused, like, as to what he was doing singing Lose Yourself, which was like 20 years ago.
Right.
There was no explanation. It was sort of out of context. He's great, and you obviously have this book that just came out. Mm-hmm. And so do you understand, like, what the context? I didn't read the article. It just came up. So
I mean, I did a post about it because I didn't understand why. The next morning I was just looking at stuff in the media, and I didn't understand why all of these reporters who, really, it doesn't take too much to figure this out. Like, no one got it. Yeah. But, I mean, the significance is...
I didn't dive deep on it, to be honest. I knew you were coming in, so I was like, maybe you can answer this.
We'll handle it. Yeah. I mean, the significance is that when he won in 2003, he didn't go to the ceremony. Because he didn't think he was going to win. He thought, like, there's absolutely no way. You know, the guy has never really liked awards shows.
Yeah, doesn't like press.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But he never really liked awards shows. You know, even back when he went to the Grammys, he was sort of begrudgingly. So he didn't think there was a snowball's chance that he was going to win. So he didn't go. He didn't want to, like, show up and feel like a loser.
Yeah.
He was actually at home reading a book to his daughter, and he fell asleep. And then his phone started blowing up. And he was like, "What?" And they're like, you won. So he's never been to the Oscars.
So he's like 20 years later, I might as well just go now.
Well, and also back then, they would have every single nominee perform a piece of the song. They used to do those medleys for a while there.
So it's still weird. I mean, half the stuff going on there, I can't. It was like a soapbox, the whole show. I really got a little bit irritating for me after a while, to be honest. I mean, I love some of the things that people have to say, but I do also want to watch it to be somewhat entertained. So I'm conflicted if I want to watch, like, half the stuff going on there. But anyway, so he did that as a sort of...
He didn't do it. They did, like... they basically had an instrumental version of the song in the medley. And then he won. So he's never been. And I think the thing that, you know, sort of... I didn't understand people's confusion, because if you listen to, Lin-Manuel Miranda. I always stumble over his name.
I can't say it either. So.
His really heartfelt speech was all about the role of music in movies, and how, you know, if there's the perfect song, it becomes intermeshed with the film forever. It's like part of the narrative. You can't think of one without the other. And then they had this montage of, you know, like 50 years of that.
Right.
And to me, I can't think of a song in recent years that has done that better than Lose Yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and it's even more like significant because it's a semi-autobiographical film. So it's not just a song that somebody wrote for the movie. It's he wrote it about his life.
Definitely.
So in that way, it makes complete sense.
Maybe an intro could have been just to kind of say, hey, Eminem's back, you know, after 20 years, he's back to reclaim, you know, the award. I don't know, just some kind of context. I didn't have any context.
Yeah, I mean,
it was great. Yeah. It's great. So the book, right? So you've written so many books, and there's so much to talk about with you in terms of, like, obviously I have my favorite. So I obviously have read the Tommy Lee book, the Slash book, a lot of those books over the years, because some of those
a lot of those guys.
Yeah, and they're like near and dear to me, and we have stories, and your stories are, you know, it's boundless, the amount of stories that you have about all these books, and I've listened to some of them already, and some are quite incredible. But how did this book come about? Right? Obviously, the show, normally what I do is I take people through people's journeys and paths and their and their upbringings, and I do want to get into kind of how you started and your beginnings as a writer, because I think you were an intern at Rolling Stone when you first started, right?
Yes, sir.
And so the path was sort of like just waiting around until that opening came. How long were you interning for?
I interned, well, back then they had a publishing division, so I interned in the books department. And I got the job because Kurt Cobain killed himself.
Wow.
And they needed, I had been accepted to as an intern for the magazine, but in the next sort of cycle.
Okay.
Because I got my resume in a little bit late. And then, so when he killed himself, they needed, you know, a bunch of hands to get this book done quickly.
Mm.
And I was sort of on the top of the heap. So I got into the books department, which was already like, you know, 1 degree separated from the magazine, because it was a really small operation. But there I learned to do research. I mean, I was a history major, so I'm like total nerd for research. So I was into that. And then
By the way, you should tell people, because I have to do research every day that I do one of these shows, or the day before, or day at, whatever it may be. And people don't realize how much work the research part is, right? So that's almost like half of your job as a writer, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot of it. I mean, I will say that it's so much easier and fun to do now. You can do it on your phone to a decent degree.
Another Wikipedia, I have to be honest.
Yeah, no, totally.
Sometimes
I mean, that's
not
good.
Accurate,
and then,
but, you know.
No, if you cross-reference it, you can do it. But, I mean, back then, there was, you know, LexisNexis, which I believe still exists.
What is that?
It's like a giant database of periodicals.
Okay. Is that pre-Wikipedia or something?
Yeah, definitely. It now, it's still a subscription service. It's like what all the magazines use to, like, you know, that's for articles from Life magazine from 1955. It goes like all the way back. It's pretty expensive per year. So, you know, at Rolling Stone, there were 5 terminals, and they were like green monitor, you know, green monitors like DOS. Like,
right, DOS. I remember that.
Let's play, you know, what's that? Oh, man. What Oregon Trail? It was like that kind of computer.
I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah. So, you know, that was where all the research was done. So when I was an intern, like, the editor would say, okay, go get me as many articles on this as possible. And I'd like go off to the library and do all that. And then
it was just like photocopying. People don't remember. Like,
there was, Rolling Stone had a proper library where they subscriptions to all the magazines, you know, they were filed. We'd photocopy it. We had stuff on all kinds of things. The coolest thing they had was a copy of every single Rolling Stone ever.
That's amazing.
And like an air cooled, you know, thing.
That's great.
So I'd read those at lunch. That was great.
Yeah. And did you ever think that you would get to write like a cover story? Because obviously people always ask me, you probably know I have a company. And so they're always like, hey, should I be an intern? I'm like, well, I did it. I don't know. You did it.
I mean,
that's how people start. You know,
I did that. And I did a lot of, like I said, I was doing research. And then so the books thing, I wasn't quite into the magazine part. And so I was like working in bars and stuff and just kept the internship going after the intern cycle was over, like twice a week, unpaid. And then I got basically asked back and they let me do more and more. So they were redoing the Rock and Roll Encyclopedia. And then I was getting to like call people and interview them. So
I interviewed
like Giorgio Moroder. They didn't know where to find him. And I like found an office number in Italy.
And this
like,
is before Google too. So you couldn't really.
It was,
I mean,
it was like cop work to some degree.
like stealth.
Yeah.
You're actually like an undercover cop or something.
So just for the thrills of being able to do that stuff, I was definitely, you know, like I said, I was working in a couple bars in East Village, and then I was super psyched to be doing that. And mostly because I was in the library so much, I became friends with the librarian, and she got a budget for an assistant, so she hired me there. And then I was doing research all the time, which was actually a little bit grueling, but it was great for when I started doing my own stuff.
And the process of doing research for you at that point, it was reading old Rolling Stone magazines, looking up articles. There wasn't YouTube. Were you referencing any video clips at that point, or was it?
There wasn't any of that. Yeah, okay. It didn't exist. Like I said, my world was like LexisNexis. Rolling Stone had a deep library of books. So, and I would also be doing stuff for advertising people and the business people. I would get in like a research request on my desk. And then I would discuss with the librarian like what the best package to put together was. Photocopy stuff, check out books. We had like a little card system. Right. It's pretty archaic.
Those books never got returned by me. I don't know why, but.
Well, in the Rolling Stone library, we'd have to go get them sometimes. I was like that guy. It was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But through that, I became really good friends with one of the assistants in the music department, who is my age. And when there was one assistant who'd been there for quite a long time and wasn't really like moving up, and she said, you know, she's going to leave. You should slide in there. Because it was when you're an assistant, you work for the music editor, you know, you got all the perks of like free tickets and albums and a chance to write if you were good enough. So,
I would have liked that job because I'm so into music. Obviously, it's like my life. Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to work at a record label when I was younger, and I did. And eventually I thought there'd be a lot of perks, and they made me like a tape listener. And there wasn't that many perks to like listening to cassettes,
just like demos.
Yeah, I'd listen to demos, and like it wasn't. Oof. But I didn't get to keep that. I don't know. There's nothing there that I got to.
For every Eminem, there's like a million. I don't people you never heard of.
It was a tough
MC Blasey Blah.
Exactly. It was a tough job, but it seems like a fun job, right? So that's kind of where it started. At a certain point, you actually. I mean, again, we're probably going a little bit forward here, but your first real big break there was the Eminem cover story.
Yeah.
So how do you go from being an assistant there to someone being, hey, you know what, this kid, just give this assistant the cover story of the Eminem cover story. There was certainly a path in between there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was working for the music editor, and actually at one point two different music editors. It was kind of a tumultuous time. Two of the guys that I assisted got fired, but I sort of persevered. And then I was working for David Frick, one of my absolute writing heroes. Yeah. He's the coolest. David, I love you. And the music editor at the same time. And I slowly, you know, they gave me articles to do. Like anything that didn't want to be done. You could tell people this.
Yeah.
If you're an intern somewhere and you want to make a name for yourself, do the stuff that nobody wants to do and do it really, really well.
Like columns, things like that.
Yeah, just like annoying stuff. I ended up getting columns. Yeah, there was in the back the charts page. We used to print the Billboard charts.
Yeah.
They started letting me do little quick interviews with like one hit wonders. Oh, so literally every late 90s one hit wonder I have interviewed.
Who, by the way, just as a side note, is there one hit wonder that you're like, this is the greatest song ever? They never had another song after that. Is there one that sticks out in your mind?
Fastball the Way? I love that song.
That's a good song.
You know that song?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that.
Is that Fastball?
I think so. Yeah.
I forget who wrote that though.
Yeah.
Someone famous,
like Fastball.
Yeah, I think it was Fastball. Yeah. There's so many. It's really funny if there's like a somebody does any kind of 90s playlist. I'm like, yep.
Have you ever heard of a band called Jellyfish?
Yes,
they're my
Jellyfish
all-time
is awesome.
Favorite band, probably maybe ever. And I guess some people that don't know 90s pop might say like they're a one-hit wonder, but
no, they're so
cool. They're beyond like incredible.
Yeah.
But for people that sometimes you don't get a chance to like dig deep in certain artists like that, but they're an incredible band like that.
Yeah, I love Jellyfish.
But yeah, we're digressing.
So I was doing like a bunch of those columns and, you know, working for two editors, taking all the writing assignments ever. I did one that got me some attention that was like there was a summer issue and it was the best summer songs of all time.
Oh, cool.
And they did Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone.
Nice.
And nobody had heard from Sly forever.
Might have been some drug.
Oh, lots.
There.
So many drugs. So many drugs. Yeah. So I found a guy. This was in, it had to be like 97, 98. I found a guy who was running the official Sly Stone, you know, website.
Okay.
And he was a kid who'd gone to Harvard. And I got in touch with him on the internet. And he was the last person to like see Sly Stone because Sly flew him out. Sly came to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995. And then no one saw him again. And this was like the late 90s now.
Huh.
And I interviewed that guy and we did an article about that. And he put me in touch with like Jerry Martini, who's the horn player, who's living in Hawaii. So I managed to pull this article together.
Did you actually find Sly, or you never found him?
I couldn't talk to Sly. He didn't want to talk.
Okay.
But John Dax asked him, and he said no. But he told me some great stuff. Like Sly was living with two identical twins.
I mean, you can't make
19-year-old women in his house, and there was like, you know, he had blacked out all the windows, and like, you know, lots of drugs going on. He had like drugs. He had hours and hours and hours of music that he'd recorded and all this craziness.
Such a shame too, right? Because such an incredible talent.
He was.
Is he still
one of my
music?
Absolute no. favorites?
He's still yet to be heard from.
Well, he had this thing where he was. I forget who his old manager was, but his manager had him on like an 18-year contract where he would be getting money, and so he deliberately wasn't doing anything because he's like, I'm not giving that guy one more cent. So that was it. That ended, though, but he's kind of a drug casualty. He was at Coachella.
Like in the audience? Or like
no, he was supposed to play Coachella. This was a while ago. I was talking to Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads about this recently because I was there and I love Sly, like deeply love Sly and wanted to see him. And he was like supposed to have a set at one of the second stages and, you know, 8 hours later, still hadn't come on. He finally came on at, like, when the only person who was still going was, like, you know, some DJ in the, like, Let's Do Molly tent,
right, like on the other side of it.
Seriously. Yeah. But Jerry waited. Jerry and his wife waited. And he said Rosanna Arquette was there. And Sly came out. And he'd been apparently, like, smoking crack with George Clinton backstage all day. He came out and he sat in like a rolling office chair, and then like the poor band was just, you know, totally rehearsed and ready to do the hits. And he's like, I want to play some new stuff. And people were like, you got to play Dance to the Music, dude.
Yeah,
you got to play something. And
we've
apparently
been waiting for 8 hours, play a hit, right?
And apparently he lay down on the stage and he was like face level with Jerry, and he takes the mic away and he's like, how long have I been on? And Jerry lied and was like, 5 minutes. And he was like, 5 minutes? It had been like 15, but he had to do like, you know, 30, 40. Yeah, I don't know what it was. And I was already, I had left. But eventually he just walked off the stage off into the crowd.
Oh,
just
my God.
Abandoned his band and stuff. So
it's such a
yes,
shame.
Yes, Scott, he's still a drug casualty.
God, it is. But you know what? It is a shame because you hear these stories. I was watching something, and again, maybe in the research I was doing about you, that like I think GNR's first record deal, they got paid $75,000, which in today's world would have been, you know, 8 million or 10 million, whatever, right? But so like, it's crazy to think that people were signing these deals. And so an 18-year, like, it's not even legal, I don't think, to sign like deals like that. But, you know, people definitely took advantage of what was going on back then. And so at a certain point, that happens, and then you end up getting this, there's an opening
to
write this cover story, right?
I was like doing all this stuff and you know, doing as much writing as I could and dying to do something bigger. I'd done Q&As. I had a column called Raves, which was like sign of the times because it wasn't about electronic music. It was about like artists would talk about their favorite things. I did that. I had the charts page in the back. I would do the occasional Q&A work, you know, stuff for like the movie issue, the fashion issue, whatever. And I had a friend in L.A. who sent me a tape of Eminem freestyling on the Wake Up Show because he just thought I'd like it. And I was like the green assistant who ran into the music editor and was like, this guy's going to be famous. And, you know, it was like, please let me write about him.
With the cassette.
It was because he was just like, he was signed. He had done some stuff on Raucous Records. Like I had heard him before, just, you know, on some underground, you know, backpacker hip hop stuff. But he did a couple freestyles that were like pretty sick. And my friend and I were both, you know, into the same kind of thing. So he literally sent me a cassette, Sign of the Times, as well.
Yeah.
And so I told my music editor, and he was like, oh, he thought it was adorable.
Right.
He was just like, you know, we don't really write about unsigned rappers. This is Rolling Stone. We barely write about hip hop.
Right.
But, you know, 2 years later, signed by Dr. Dre, it's 1999 now, and he basically said, you know, okay, My Name Is video was out. It was all over MTV back when they played music.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, I'm going to let you write 400 words on this video because it's like crazy. People are going nuts. And then they got the numbers for what it was going to do the first week, which, again, people used to buy records, and that was a big deal. And he, you know, he could have given it, I mean, to his credit, he could have given it to a more experienced writer. It was in an early issue in the year, which are usually slim, so maybe he's like, I'll take a risk on this kid. And I was busting my butt. I was doing like 5 columns and all this stuff. So he just was like, hey, here's your big break. Don't fuck it up. Oh, can I curse? He was
This is the internet. We can do whatever we want here.
Yeah, he was like, don't fuck it up. You're going to Detroit. Good luck.
Amazing. And I'm assuming you were incredibly nervous. Had you met a lot of like rock stars at that point, or was it, or not really? You were sort of stuck with like the fastballs of the world and the.
I mean that know, I was I had
the one hit wonders.
I had done Random Notes.
Okay,
so Random Notes was like the party section. I'd been doing that for 2 years too. I think yeah, was I doing Random? Yes, I was doing Random Notes at the time. I just started doing that about 6 months earlier, which is like super. That's kind of a prestigious thing to get. Like Cameron Crowe did it.
Yeah.
Kurt Loder did it. I was super psyched. And that's the only part of Rolling Stone that you could kind of be snarky, which I enjoy any chance to kind of be a wise ass. And you cover parties and it's really fun. So I've been doing that for not too long and was gearing up to cover the Grammys for the first time, which is like the biggest thing that the Random Notes person has to do every year.
Yeah.
And then the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction.
We'll come back in just a moment and talk about your first cover story, up into the fact that you just wrote the book, right? The book just came out. When did the book just come out? The second Eminem. So second Eminem book out now. And we'll be back in just a moment with Anthony. 2 seconds.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey, guys, we are back.
Yeah.
Did you watch the Grammys, by the way?
Do you mean the Oscars?
Yeah, sorry. Or you know what? I don't know what day it is. There's so many award shows in L.A.
Yeah.
Did you watch the Oscars? The Oscars.
I got to say, the Oscars is the only one I always watch.
You do? Okay.
I always watch
did
the Oscars.
Did you like it?
The Grammys, I don't care about anymore. I mean, I really did. I thought it was a good show.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it was like the least viewed ever, but I thought it was pretty entertaining. I like the no host thing because you get a lot of opportunities to see different people up there.
Definitely. I was excited to see Steve Martin. My 15-year-old self was like, Saturday Night Live.
They were funny. And Chris were great. I thought that was pretty good. Yeah, you know, cool. The Oscars clearly is having some sort of, they're having like, it's not really an identity crisis. They're just sort of like, I don't know. I think they're controlled. There's a great article, I think, in the National Review. It was a National Review about how like Twitter has changed the Oscars and like they're really, it's too self-conscious.
Well, that's what Chris Rock was saying. He's like, there's no host because everyone has a Twitter. Someone has made a tweet at some point that was like a bit controversial. But this is your second book
on
Eminem.
Yes.
Which is great. And so I actually heard this great story about first time you met him was in a bathroom. I think you believe he was throwing up.
Yep.
You want to tell that story? Cause it's
sure.
A great story,
so. That was so, you know, when I did my first cover story, like we were saying before, I'd done small articles with people, met some, you know, some of the big ones. But if I'm doing Random Notes, it's like a quick thing, a lot of phone stuff. I'd done a few in-person things. But I hadn't had a, you know, this is like I'm spending like significant amount of time. I'm going to be in New York going to shows with this person. I'm going to Detroit, all of it.
Now, are they flying you first class, just out of curiosity for this, or are you in economy?
No, I was next to Eminem in economy.
He was in economy too?
Yeah.
Really?
He had not gotten any of his money from Interscope yet.
Okay.
He had an eviction notice on his door.
Wow.
When we got to his trailer, still in a trailer with Kim.
He was living in a trailer.
He's living in a trailer. Wow. He didn't really have any apartment at that time. He had a trailer that he had gotten for his mom who didn't pay the rent, and there was literally a pink slip on the door when we got there. And it wasn't faked. It really wasn't.
Which the process of writing with someone like that, and again, I know it's about, I'm sort of referencing things that I've heard before, but almost like it's like dating and courting, right? You have to make someone trust you. You have to make someone sort of make sure that, you know, they can put their faith in your hands, especially if you're going to be their voice in a book, right? So walk me through your first meeting with him and how that went. And like, because he's, you know, he can, it seems like he's a bit of a hard guy in terms of like his exterior, not the soft, you know, the warm, fuzzy type, unless I'm sort of misreading something.
No, he's very private. It's a blue collar kid from Detroit, you know.
So was it
from
a
Detroit,
good first meeting? How was it? Like, did you wine and dine him? Was there did you bring him chocolates? What happened?
God, I showed up at the at Paul Rosenberg, his manager's first office, and walked in, and there was a conference room where I was told to wait. And there's no one in there except for the big security guard, the one who actually ended up writing a tell-all about Eminem. And I was like, well, you know, he's like, yeah, they're in Paul's office. He's like, oh, but Marshall's in there. And he points to this other door. So I thought it was another room. So I go in there and it's a bathroom. It's like a couple stalls. And I just hear him completely barfing, just retching. And it was one of those situations where I opened the door. And the door like automatically shut, and then it was like dead silence. And he paused for a second, and I was like, "Oh God, okay." So he knows I'm in here, and now I'm in here.
Do you go in? Do you
exactly.
not go in? What do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
And then so he gets up, flushes the toilet, comes out of the stall, and looks at me, and I'm just, I mean, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm Anthony, I'm introducing myself. And he just looks at me and burps and leaves. It's like,
which is a great first picture.
God, it also smelled. So it was like, so he had done his photo shoot for the cover with David LaChapelle, and David LaChapelle, he was like, the cover was supposed to be him naked holding a giant stick of dynamite, like Bugs Bunny style, over his junk. That ended up going inside because we had some conservative advertisers who freaked out.
Right.
So he, you know, told me later he'd like never been around, you know, like David LaChapelle's studio was famous. It's just like drag queens and craziness. And so he got really nervous and drank like a whole fifth of Bacardi, like on an empty stomach. And that's why he was puking. So I after that, I sat in this conference room. And then when it was time to go, I got in a limo with Stretch Armstrong, who's DJing for him at the time.
Yeah.
And everyone to do these promo shows. And Eminem didn't talk to me for the first 24 hours.
Which is always weird. I met people like that. And you're like, how do you?
It was so strange. Yeah, I was like, I'm screwed. Really yeah. I was like, I'm going to lose my job. Yeah. I'm going to just answer phones forever. Yeah. Rolling Stone. So we draw, you know, he just keeps looking at me though. And he was checking me out the whole night. And then, so right after this, we go and we stop somewhere.
Now, do you try and say hello and engage with him, or he just sort of
he was on the
even...
other side of the limo. It was a big stretch limo. It was like Paul Rosenberg, the bodyguard. Paul's a giant dude. The bodyguard's a giant dude. Stretch Armstrong's like 6'4". He's skinny though.
So you don't even try and engage with him.
Like he and Stretch were on the other side of the car, and I was like sandwiched against the window next to these two massive, you know, humans. So I'm just kind of like, I'm slow shit. What's going to happen here? So, you know, we kind of pull away and then we pull up and this guy comes knocking on the window. And I was like, well, I didn't really know what to do. And this is the only time Eminem really interacted with me. He kicked me in the leg and handed me money. And I was like, and then went and like, you know, made a gesture with his head. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's a drug deal. So
I
put the window down.
I wouldn't even know. I thought it could have been a homeless person.
I had no idea. The guy was like getting angry, knocking on the window, and I'm like, hi. And so I give him the money, and he puts like a pile of ecstasy pills in my hand, capsules. And I give it back to M, and he and Stretch start, you know, it's like doing
their thing.
And Paul Rosenberg, and I've talked to, you know, known Paul ever since and talked to him over the years. And I was like, just tell me the truth. Was any of that? He's like, none of it was set up. We were way too fucking disorganized for this. So Paul was furious with him. And he's like, great job, Marshall. You just let the Rolling Stone reporter literally buy drugs for you. Fuck you. You're on your own. And he got out and called himself his own car for the rest of the night. He's like, I'm not being a part of this. And
did that make it into the article?
It's all in the article. I literally put every single thing that happened to me in that.
It's like Almost Famous, if you guys have seen that movie.
It was like Almost Famous.
So did you, at that point, you know, are you worried that if you do like sort of this tell-all that he's going to turn against you? Because you obviously develop these rapports with these guys where you go on then to write books with them. And all the guys that you've written books with, whether it be Tommy Lee, whether it be Slash, a lot of them you're still very friendly with.
Yeah,
I know that you're
them.
Very friendly with Tommy because I just
all
know
the time.
From knowing you and whatever.
Yeah.
And he's, because I've met him before, and he actually, when I went to his house once, just a funny story. Like, I never met him, and you'll relate to this story. You know, he's whatever he is, 6'2", right? He opens up the door in the valley, and, you know, he was like my childhood idol as a drummer growing up. And he's like, dude, come in, and hugs me. I was like, I don't even know this guy. But I was like, great. This is all, like, it's like we're friends, and I never met him before. And he has that thing about him. But a lot of these guys, you go on to, like, whether it be live with or cohabitat with them in a way that, like, they want you to really understand who they are. So does that happen with Eminem?
So you know, the rest of the night was he played all these promo gigs, one of which was a Sweet 16 in Staten Island for some mobster's daughter. That was, I'll never forget that. That was insane. Because he needed the money. They had booked all these things, and I think it was like $5,000 an appearance to do like three songs. And he literally needed the money because he hadn't gotten his Interscope money yet. Yeah. The album was just starting to sell, you know. So anyway, the whole night he's rapping and he still doesn't talk to me. But the next day when we got on the plane, he sort of, you know, like opened up and he decided to sit next to me, made Paul move, sat next to me. And we just started talking and, you know, we talked about like just growing up, parents divorced and shit like that, you know, just bonded on normal human stuff.
The truth is a lot of these guys really are shielded. So they don't have a lot of friends. Like I know I work with and know so many celebrities I've been friendly with over the years, and you'd be surprised, and people would be surprised at how many of them are so lonely because they're so insulated that they don't, they have like a handful of friends. So
yeah.
I don't know.
I mean,
who
M,
he is, but that's,
M now is very much that. I think he talks to like seven people.
Yeah. And it's like, of course you're going to be weird if you don't talk to people during the day and you don't trust anyone.
He he was more out there then. But yeah. So anyway, somewhere during that flight, he just decided he turned around and told Paul, he's like, this guy's going to interview my mom. And that's
amazing.
It. So I'm the only one that he allowed to do that. And we just, you know, we found some common ground and that was it. And
so now you're on your second book, right?
I decided to put all the stuff in the article.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I mean, Slim Shady LP pulls no punches.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
he's
definitely
not shy about like doing drugs and being ridiculous. And I just put it all in there. So,
yeah,
and
so
they loved it.
So now fast forward, you're on your second book with
him,
right? And so obviously you have this incredible trust level with him. And why do you think that is? You think you guys just really bonded after the first book was successful? You're like, nah, because
I mean, it's a unique, they let, the thing with the first book was, you know, 8 Mile came out, he kind of told his story that way, and I wanted to do the book because I felt like I had a unique perspective, and they basically said, we're gonna give you everything you need, but it's not going to be like a co-written autobiography,
right?
You know, because what I do is either a biography or a co-write with the person, which is a whole different process. So those guys, you know, they let me interview, do some more interviews if I needed them. I had a ton of stuff because I'd done 2 cover stories with them and spent a lot of time with him back when he was like more willing to hang out with people.
Yeah.
So I had plenty of stuff, and that's what that book was. This one is totally different. Like, he's basically, you know, he's 11, 12 years sober. His whole entire world is just down to like a few people. He decided he doesn't really want to do press or interviews anymore, sort of, you know, midway through our process. So it was like a very
different
kind of book.
You do every interview with this book. I'm not doing any more interviews.
It was like, you know, I wanted to write about this sort of second half of his career because I feel like the media loved him for a while and then really kind of
turned on him. Yeah.
And people, I was just getting sick of people saying like, you know, his albums are trash just because they don't like what he's saying. Like,
right.
Technically, he's the most talented rapper out there.
Yeah.
I just say he's better than he was before. Like, in terms of technical ability, it's, you know, it's kind of breathtaking sometimes what he can do. And his rhyme structures are so complicated now that his mind is clear and all that. And I was just kind of tired. I mean, a lot of the reason why I wanted to do it too is that I was sick of, I just feel like music journalism has changed so much, and I could go on about this forever, but it's because it has to be faster.
Yeah,
a lot of it,
everything has to be. I mean, we're living this like ADD society, but you know, everything you do, it's interesting, Anthony, and not to sort of digress from that, but I feel like you have a very unique perspective, because you sort of, even the Tommy Lee book, at some point you can tell the story about how someone said this book should be written from the perspective of
his dong.
Right. Which
that
is,
was like,
which
well,
is weird, right? So
well,
that's
I,
a weird thing.
Yeah,
so
that was weird, like, you know, a joke. I when I was getting ready to go out to move to LA to hang out with him, I was hanging out with some friends, and you know, the Motley Crue book was out, and I was just like asking them, like, you know, what do you guys know Tommy Lee for besides, you know, Motley Crue? And everybody was like, sex tape, big dick. Right. Using it to honk a horn on a boat. And I was like, so on the ride out there, on the flight out there, between like dozing off, I was like, thought it would really be funny if his penis argued with him about who's more famous.
Right.
Because those are the two
that,
things
just,
he's known for.
I was
for.
Thinking, wow, this is a wild perspective, right?
And so that, I mean, that whole, just to jump to that story, you know, I went out there and was set up, and Tommy was like in, he was supposed to be there and was away for 2 weeks. Like, the first 2 weeks I was in LA, like, he was like, had gone to Mexico. He was just like partying with people.
No one told you,
No one really told me.
He was with Sean in like some remote island.
He didn't even know Sean.
Okay.
Sean wouldn't even know him if it wasn't for me. it's true. And so, anyway, so he was like in Mexico with a, you know, a rich friend of his. And anyway, he came back and I was finally was up there, and I was all, this is my first co-written book. You know, I just finished the Eminem book. It wasn't even published yet. That was a whole ordeal. This was the first time I was going to be like, you know, now I've jumped the fence from, you know, being an interviewer.
Yeah.
Because what you were saying before, either you do develop a trust with people, or old school interviewers also had the thing of like, I'm watching you. I'm asking you hard questions.
Right.
And then it's that sort of conflict thing.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of trust and bond too. That's like the two styles of interviews, old school interviews, that I, I think are good. And they usually get the honesty out of people. So anyway, this is the first time I'm sort of jumping the fence. And now I'm like, I'm on your team. I'm here to make you look good. Let's figure this out.
Yeah.
So I was being all professional. I had all these ideas. And Tommy, is like 11 a.m. And he's like, hey, do you want something to drink? And I was like, yeah, I'll have an iced tea. And then he's like, I'll be right back. Comes back with iced tea, lemonade, and a giant trough and three bottles of flavored vodka and just puts it down. He's like, oh, no, man, they were in the ice chest, you know? And I'm like, all right.
Which is exactly how he is when you know him. He's so just how like he a is. Giant kid.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That started. So he started drinking. And then I was like, he was like, again, I'm explaining all my shit. And he's just like looking around at birds and shit. And I'm like, this guy's not even listening to me. So I'm like, you know what I really want to do? I want to have your dick be a character. And I want your dick to argue with you about who made all the decisions in your life, really.
Right.
And he like looks at me, he like stops and he looks at me. And then we're out by the pool and he picked me up in the chair and threw me in the pool. And I was like, oh fuck, is he going to beat me up? Like, what's happening? And then he jumped in after me and like, we both sort of came up to the surface and he looked at me. He's like, it's going to be a great summer, dude. I fucking love it. And like hugged me and that was it.
Amazing.
So then the whole goal was like, let's take apart every element of what it is to do a co-written autobiography. Like, I'm in the footnotes reporting when Tommy's wrong, which is like another funny element rather than just correcting it. And then we had like a British editor who didn't get a lot of the American humor. And Tommy was looking over my shoulder while I'm like answering his edit notes. And he's like, who's saying that? That's a stupid question. So then he was so funny about it that I started like writing down what he said.
That's right. Yeah.
And then we had that in there. Yeah, and then penis interrupts. And all right. Yeah. He's like, no, dude, I saw her first. Like that kind of shit through the whole book. So it's super fun.
Yeah. You're such a great, because a lot of what you do, these co-writes, obviously, is such an interesting perspective. I never get to play hard rock on the show because truth is we're sort of on this pop alternative rock station, but I feel like now would be a great time to jump to Dr. Feelgood because we're talking about Motley Crue. They got a huge tour
coming
up.
It's gonna be the biggest tour this summer.
Biggest tour of the summer. Might be the only time I'll ever get to play Motley Crue on the radio.
Do it.
So let's jump to Dr. Feelgood and come back and talk. I want to talk Mick Fleetwood
let's
for a moment, and I definitely want to talk about Slash because there's no way we're getting out of here without talking about Guns N' Roses.
That'd be bad. Also, and, a big tour.
Big tour too. Yeah. So we'll be back in just a second with Anthony Bozo.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey guys, we're back. A couple quick other stories because there's so many. Listen, you have so many books you've written.
I'll come back.
I mean, there's Mick Fleetwood stories.
Yep.
There's obviously Slash stories, right?
Slash stories.
So
are good.
Why don't we? Because I'm not even gonna get into all the you've done all the sports stuff, Derek Jeter. You've done AC/DC would be great. But are there a couple other stories that sort of resonate with you that are like, hey, when I was writing the, because again, your perspective has always been like, you actually get into the mind of these people, you live with them, and then in some cases, right?
Yeah, most, I mean, the ones that I really kind of bond with, like the best, I feel like if you really, most, the best books I've done are, I spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah, well, you lived with Tommy, for instance.
For a year.
I know every time he wanted to talk about Motley Crue, he made you do like Jägermeister shots or something.
Yeah, so or Jack.
Yeah, so half that book is probably like a blur to you, right?
Yes. Well, I couldn't leave. I had an apartment that was part of my contract that was like, you know, in Santa Monica, and he lived in like a canyon above Malibu at the time. And I just to get through like a normal day of interviewing, I was way too hammered to drive a car.
Exactly.
And I'd end up spending, you know, he's like, after I'd be there for 5 days because I was never sober enough to just get the hell out of there and get some new clothes. He'd be like, look at all these free clothes I got, dude. You don't need them. I was just, and then eventually he's like, I don't think I want to pay for your apartment anymore, buddy. He's like, I haven't had a male roommate in a long time. Let's do this shit. It was, I mean, you've met him. He's just a bundle of joy.
Yeah. Fast forward, you're still living with him now, like 10 years later. No, yeah, but
he doesn't know it. I'm stalking him. I'm in a tool shed.
So you work with obviously somebody. You can't let these people know that they're sort of some, in some cases, your childhood idols. But like you ended up working with Mick Fleetwood.
Yeah.
Obviously, we spoke about Derek Jeter, AC/DC, Slash. So which ones of these kind of really resonate with you? And which of these books now, right? Some of them are years later, really like, hey, there was the time this happened with Slash or whether it happened with Mick Fleetwood that really sort of resonates still in your memory and that you really hold like fond memories about.
Yeah.
Or not so fond memories, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Tommy, I'd lived with Tommy Lee for 9 months. That's like, I'll never forget that. He's one of my best friends and that was incredible.
And some
somehow
fun times.
I made it out alive.
Yeah.
And,
some fun times. I imagine,
everything's
right?
intact on the outside.
Yeah.
That was incredible. Slash was, you know, what I loved so much about Slash was that, you know, the public perception, especially when Guns is around, is just, you know, completely wasted, just amazing guitar player. How is he pulling this off? But that guy is super committed to what he does. And when he like got his head around it and sort of we built a trust, he was super into it. I mean, he'd just gotten sober. So we would meet at midnight to 4 a.m. 3 days a week.
That's like the only time that you guys did work.
Most of the time, yeah, there'd be some daytime stuff, but he used to, right before he got fully clean, he was hanging out. He would put his kids to bed, wife would go to bed, and then from like midnight to four, he would go down to his little sort of recording studio hang area and like do drugs and jam on guitar and record some things just for himself. So he basically filled that time that he wasn't doing anymore with me and talking. And we used to play, the Guitar Hero that he's featured in had just come out. So we used to play that. And one of my fondest memories is beating Slash's ass as himself. But
at Guitar Hero.
Yeah, Guitar Hero. Of course, dude.
Were you playing Guns N' Roses or were you playing something else?
We're doing Motley. And I remember he's like, I could play the song really. Like, it was really funny watching him get frustrated. But here's what kind of work ethic this guy has. He went on a snowboarding vacation with the kids. Brought that with him and was gone for like 2 weeks. And when we came back, he was like amazing. And I couldn't beat him. And I was like, oh my God.
Well, he's a musical genius. So obviously he's.
But I mean, Guitar Hero is nothing like actually playing the song.
I can't play drums at Guitar Hero to save my life. I'm terrible at it. But I don't really think it's like playing the instrument. If I have to.
No, it's nothing like playing the instrument.
If I have to speak from the musician standpoint.
Yeah, it's not.
I don't even know where the correlation is between playing an instrument and Guitar Hero because I find them completely different.
It is.
It's like
that's what he was.
It's like Tetris or something weird.
It's like Simon.
Yeah, it's like Simon, exactly.
That's what he was super mad at. Yeah.
So you beat him. Were you playing like Girls, Girls, Girls? Or what was the song?
I forget which Motley song it is. I think it's Kickstart Your Heart.
Okay, great song.
Maybe. I don't remember which one is featured in there. But anyway, it was funny to like be playing, like, and we were both playing his little avatar.
Yeah,
it's like Slash playing his own avatar.
And you went on tour with him when he was in, what, Velvet Revolver? Because he wasn't in Guns when you were writing that book with him, right?
No, not at all. I mean, there's so many moments. Like, I would say the stuff with Slash, just him, he's just so damn cool.
Yeah.
Like, he embodies the coolness.
Definitely.
You know, like showing up at his house at midnight and he's like, it in a robe that says Slash from like a Japanese tour and a big towel like turban
with the
on his head.
On,
he's
right?
like, no, he had like a turban. He's like, come on in, man. Like, he's just the coolest dude.
Yeah.
So I mean, just the memories of honestly, like, he really was committed to every detail and going through like every element of that story. And to me, you know, he had never really done interviews. He didn't like doing that stuff.
Yeah. I still don't think he loves doing them. He seems still a bit uncomfortable when he's doing them, like he doesn't really want to be there. You know? So.
This was kind of the start of getting him to do that. And I remember, like, you know, hearing it was like 6 months later, he started doing more like TV stuff and everything. And he kind of told me that, you know, this process was really, really good for him and it made him do that more. But honestly, just having I was just so, you know, happy and proud with every session because this is somebody who'd never told all of his like absolutely amazing life.
Yeah.
So I was
that's
just
a pretty incredible
story, there.
Right? I mean, people don't know the story. It's like 400 pages, but one of the greatest rock and roll stories ever.
Yeah.
And still one of the biggest bands ever. I think their tour was still at this point, I think it's the second biggest or largest grossing rock tour of all time at this point, which
it was
is crazy.
Insane. It was like 140 million.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, the thing that really made me proud is that he had met with like seven different writers over the years before that. And he's just like, nope, nope, nope. And I was like,
for some reason you guys connected. But again, why do you think that people trust you? Is it the fact that are you whining and dining them? Are you making, is there a dating process to how you get familiar with them? How does it happen? Because these guys have to say, you know what? I met with six or seven other writers. I know that you've done, Rolling Stone cover stories and you've a bunch of books that have done incredibly well. Some of them New York Times bestsellers, but there's something that's making them trust you because I know that process in just interviewing people now. And obviously you have your own podcast, which we should talk about.
Yeah.
But the process of getting people to open up isn't always easy.
No, it's hard. Slash, I know for a fact, cause he told a mutual friend that he decided to do the book with me because we spent 7 hours talking the first time we met for this reason. And I was the only person who did not ask about Guns N' Roses or Axl Rose. And
amazing.
That's why he decided to do it. Because he started talking about his childhood. We were in the Sunset, the Roosevelt. No, the Sunset. the Sunset Towers? Yeah, that hotel that overlooks the Strip. Yeah. And we were overlooking it, and he started telling stories looking out at the Strip just about his childhood and how Seymour Cassell, you know, RIP, who just, he was the one who named him Slash, and how, like, there was a house where, you know, he and Polanski grew pot and all this stuff. And I was just, like, riveted, fascinated. And we talked all about his childhood, and I didn't even ask about
his mom was a costume designer, I believe, right? And she designed for Sly Stone, I think, to all these other people.
And she did, like, did stuff for Ringo Starr and John Lennon. Yeah. She did all the costumes for The Man Who Fell to Earth. She had an affair with David Bowie. And, like, it's just amazing, amazing shit. Like, amazing shit. So that, I was riveted. So that did it there. I mean, it's hard to get people's trust. You know, you got to, like, approach them as a human.
We were
You want to go back to research? I tell everyone, do your research. Just know everything.
Totally. We were talking before you got here, and I unfortunately can't mention the name, but there was a guy that I interviewed quite recently who you definitely knows super well, that as soon as he walked in, he was like, I do not want to talk about the past. And you know, there was like 25 years of iconic rock stuff there that's kind of what people wanted to know about. So I was annoying. How do I pivot with my, you know, 17 hours of research here, because there really wasn't like a huge amount to talk about in terms of where things were going at that point. So that, has that ever happened to you when you sit with people and they don't want, because I know we touched base on it, but Tommy didn't want to talk about Motley, Slash didn't want to talk about Guns N' Roses. I mean, essentially, this is definitely what people want to hear about sometimes, right? It's like, I talk to artists all the time about, you know, a lot of them are playing these shows and people are paying $1,000 a ticket and they don't want to play the hits. And I'm like, no offense, but not to be rude, but I mean, people don't care that you played that song for 10 years. Like, that's one of the things that have made you successful.
So, that's what they're paying for.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you know, you should probably find a happy medium there where you do your artistic, you know, your artistic vision is intact and you can do your new stuff. But people also always want to go back to the fact that those are the memories that they hold, and those are the things that resonate with them the most. So
it's tough. I mean, you know, if I was in that position, I'm trying to think, that's definitely happened during my Rolling Stone career, but I think that,
like, was the worst, can you say, like, the worst interview you ever did?
Well, I did, I mean, the most disappointing, I don't really, I mean, Bob Weir was kind of a jerk. Unfortunately,
when people are a jerk, it's so disappointing, right?
It was like, I was also like super young and green, and we were doing that same summer issue that the Sly Stone story happened. It was like your first summer job was one of the questions. Just, you know, it's like one of those feel-good magazine pieces that were when there were magazines they used to have room for when people advertised and, you know, people read them.
When they weren't listening to podcasts.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's still lots of, like, fluffy clickbait stuff like that still done. Yeah. So, anyway, I think I asked him that, and he was like, you know, it's the Grateful Dead. This is Rolling Stone magazine. Not many other places are covering the Grateful Dead. Like, they've had a long relationship.
Yeah.
So he was just like super angry that I was even asking that. He's like, well, you know, I had like one job and then I've been in the Grateful Dead. Like, are you even aware of that? I'm like, yeah, dude.
I think I know.
I've been to
band,
a lot of shows, actually.
I think I know what band you played in.
So that was kind of mean. I'm trying to think of who else was like really bad interview.
It's just disappointing, right?
It's when just sometimes
just not cool. Like, why, right? What?
Sometimes
it's so
people
easy
are
to be cool
to
people.
Yeah, sometimes people are having a bad day. But
did anybody really surprise you, where you were like, wow, you know, I really didn't go into this interview thinking this person would be great, and you know what? We're like great friends now. We holiday together. Besides Tommy Lee.
I mean, Mick Fleetwood is like the greatest.
Yeah,
person
I
want to
know about him
the
because
world.
there's very few people I don't know now because I feel like there's been this Fleetwood Mac sort of revival. Even people like Harry Styles, obviously, they're referencing Fleetwood Mac, and he's performing with Stevie Nicks. And you know what? Good on you, the fact that they're having this incredible resurgence, because they're incredible. And so I'd love to know. I never met Mick Fleetwood. Like, what's he like? Is he great?
Oh, my God.
Because I could picture him being, like, not great, but you're saying the opposite. Like,
he's
in my
fantastic
mind, I was like, maybe he's not that nice, but he's great.
No, he is absolutely fantastic. I mean, he won't do anything he doesn't want to do, and he's getting older. But Mick Fleetwood, I tell everyone that if I just say he is the classic rock version of Gandalf, Lord
Amazing.
Of the Rings.
That's what he's like. He was on your podcast. We should talk
he
about
was.
Your podcast.
He
your
was.
Podcast basically pairs wine with rock stars, and you talk about the pairings of music and wine and whatnot.
It's either people in the music world. I mean, it can be anybody, but basically somebody comes. It's called Wynal, like wine and vinyl, and somebody picks a record that changed their life, or an artist, a musical artist. And I work with some great wine buyers in California called Wine Exchange. They're amazing. Guy Kyle Meyer, he's like a huge music nerd and a genius of wine buying and tasting.
Because you're so super passionate about wine.
Like, oh my God, I love wine. So anyway, Kyle and I, the person picks a record or an artist, and then Kyle and I pick a wine that would go perfectly with it. And then we talk about what that album means to the person and, you know, then the making of this wine. And I ask them if they think we got it right. And it's really
fun. Mick Fleetwood, like, a great guest on the show?
Mick is great. See, I got to stay with him for a while on his like farm in Maui.
Oh, right.
I mean, that's another moment I'm like, I'd like walk out of the guest cabin on the hillside all the way up in the crater in Maui with mist and like wild, you know, pheasant running around because
like
it used
Lord
to be
of the Rings or something.
Yeah,
or something
it used to be owned by like an English lord, and right. There's pheasant to hunt there around and stuff. And I'm in a log cabin that was built in '71 from, you know, trees on the property with my wood burning stove. And I'm
does
just
he have
like,
a drum set there? Does he even play?
Oh, yeah.
He does.
Okay. It's like the house is really funky and super cool. Like the main room is his jam room. And like Willie Nelson comes up and plays all the time. And now Steven Tyler.
I was
going to
say, I know Steven pretty
street.
Well. And I know
yeah,
Steven
they hang out
always,
a lot.
Yeah, they always do these jams and benefits. And,
yeah.
And Steven, for me, is my spirit animal. He's the coolest guy I've ever.
He's super cool.
He's the greatest. I mean, you should write his book.
I would love to think he did one.
I think, but another one or something.
He was the greatest. I interviewed him when I was at Rolling Stone, and we had to continue the interview. This is what a real professional is. He had to do something. We had to continue the interview. He could have blown it off, but he didn't. I was like, well, I'm going to, is it okay if I go home? He's like, yeah, get out of that office, man. So I was like, so he called me at home and he called like just before I got there. And this is answering machine day. So I still have the tape and he, you know, my thing clicks in. He goes, Boza, just like does that whole thing. And he's like, what a cool name, man. Double Z's. And I was just like, you're awesome.
I think that
he's
the coolest guy ever. But I think that he has... Sorry, I have to clear my throat here. I think that he has some of the same spiels because obviously my last name is Lips, and whenever I would see him,
that?
He would say to me, you know, my last, you know, like Lips, that should be my last name. And I was like,
it
well,
should
it's because
be.
Of his, you know. But
that's true.
He's called me sometimes from like a block number, and then I pick up and I'm like, holy shit, like the 10-year-old in me is still like, Steven Tyler's actually calling me from a block number.
Yeah,
and
that
I've
stuff
had, like,
doesn't go away.
I once had like a 30-minute conversation with him on the phone. I was like, this is the weirdest day ever. It was for his charity. He has Janie's fund, so
yeah.
He was raising awareness, and we were talking about his event and whatnot. But yeah, so many great stories. Obviously,
yeah,
congrats on the Eminem book.
Thanks.
Check out your podcast, right?
Yep, we're about to do season 2. The Mick Fleetwood episode will be on there.
Maybe you can come on the show again with Mick Fleetwood, because I mean, that could
that
be cool.
That would be great.
Right?
Yeah.
I'll bring like wine or something. That could be cool.
Be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what he likes.
If you're on it, he might be like, yeah, I'll do it, because, you know, Anthony's on the show. So
yeah.
Then he'll feel comfortable. You need that comfortability thing.
Yeah. So. We had a great episode. We basically went through rock and roll from the 50s through the 70s with three different types of wine. And
amazing.
He just like, you know, just pontificated on what it was like playing like, you know, blues bars in 67 with Peter Green. It was
incredible.
Awesome.
But you had to do that in Hawaii? Or did
No, we did that
thing?
In his hotel when Mac was playing here.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
Like, a couple of months ago.
Amazing.
It was a while ago, yeah.
Cool. Well, what's on the horizon? Obviously, the Eminem book.
Yep, Eminem book
about,
came out.
We spoke about the Oscars, so we touched base on that. And what do you got going on the rest of the year? I'm sure always projects.
Yes, I've got two things that are proposals that will be going out. One is Jerry Harrison from the Talking Heads.
Amazing.
Which I'm very excited about. And the other one is...
So that would be a Talking Heads book or Jerry Harrison book?
Jerry's memoir about being in the Talking Heads and the Modern Lovers.
Great. Amazing.
People forget that he was the Modern Lovers, one of the quintessential, you know, proto-punk bands.
Definitely.
So,
kind of the precursor to the Strokes, a little bit.
In a lot of ways, yeah. Absolutely. And especially, like, if you listen to, like, Parquet Courts and the people who've copied the Strokes and are going a little more retro than the Strokes. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure. And the other person I'm working with is Raekwon from the Wu-Tang Clan.
Very cool.
Which is
so
dope.
I haven't even
announced that anywhere on my social media.
Amazing.
So
maybe 10 New York Times bestsellers by the time.
I hope so.
All is said and done.
Raekwon's stories are amazing.
Well, you got great stories. I thought I had good stories, and then just to hear you, like... Because once you're writing books with people and
my job is to get the story.
That's
so
it,
I
right?
just have a well of them in my pocket.
Definitely.
You know? They're other people's, but they're good.
Great. And your podcast is obviously something you're pretty passionate about.
Yeah,
so.
It's called Winyl. Season 1 is up there. There was a bit of a break, but we're going to have season 2 up, I mean, in a couple months.
Who's on season 2? Have you done it yet?
I have half of it done. What I did last time, I mean, you know, podcasts, you sort of learn as you go.
Yeah, I'm still learning. I don't know what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, I'm getting all of it done, all of it edited. edited and then releasing it regularly.
Okay.
Because I had sort of a – I hired a guy, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. Not a very good sound person.
By the way, you got to do stuff yourself because it's just like, you know, we've all – I've actually did – just to digress for one second, I did one incredible episode with a band that was really hard to get on the show. And then like
Who
a couple
it?
Days – I don't even want to say because then they'll know the story. But
so diplomatic.
Then a couple days later, the engineer was like – I think there was like a problem with the mic. I was like, what do you mean a problem with the mic? He's like, well, we can't really use the interview. I'm like, I can't call them again and do the interview. Like, you got to fix it. But he wasn't able to salvage it. So
there is
a couple episodes that are not online. And,
oh,
you know,
that
you
stinks.
Could probably figure it out. But anyway.
Yeah, what I'm going to, so far I've got, we've got half of them done. Got Alex Skolnick from Testament.
Cool. Very cool.
And the Alex Skolnick Trio. He's like a whole jazz thing that's incredible. Fleetwood.
So Mix hasn't been up yet.
No, it's not up yet. Right.
So we'll have to
I'm
wait
excited.
If we do hours to post it like a month later.
You know, there you go.
In the podcast world.
I've got the guy, the founder of Big Gay Ice Cream.
Very cool.
Doug
yeah,
Quinn.
Right.
He's hilarious. We talked about Duran Duran and drank rosé champagne.
Awesome.
Like, on brand.
So it's not only musicians. It's
no,
like a, it's
no.
Like
it's, and I get a lot of winemakers and writers too.
Right.
So it's pretty fun. We haven't done any athletes yet. I'm definitely doing one with Raekwon because he has a Lambrusco line. He's
wow,
got wine.
Cool. Amazing.
So we're going to do that one.
Cool.
Michael Azrad, famous Rolling Stone writer, and then some winemakers. You probably wouldn't know. But
so tune
really
in,
cool.
Download that.
Yep.
It's available.
Wine-al.
Does it come out every Thursday? When's the
release? You know what? We're going to let Sean figure that out.
Okay.
I'm just getting them all recorded and edited and then being like, here you go.
Yeah.
You set
so
the
Wine-al with a W. Check it out. Follow Anthony on social media. Definitely get the new Eminem book, which is great.
Please. It's called Not Afraid.
Man, this was really fun. We didn't even have a chance to talk about the Struts, a band we both love. The future of rock and roll. I mean,
I don't know.
In 10 seconds, we can just say, are there bands that you feel are still holding the flag for rock and roll? I mean, the Struts being one of them, obviously. Who else?
Struts.
I mean, we could talk about this forever, but at some point we do have to end. But
I mean, the Struts, the bar is high with the Struts. I don't know.
Who else? Are there other bands that you're like, you know, these bands for me? Because, you know, it's always interesting to talk to people that are around music so much and still passionate about music. Because I know I am, but you don't meet that many people that are...
That love the rock.
Yeah. Well, especially the rock, right? Because people love whatever. But rock and roll is... unfortunately, it's in a dying place.
Proper rock and roll like that. I don't know. I didn't really... do you have anyone?
Well,
any
obviously
ones?
there's the usual suspects.
Barnes Courtney's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, Greta Van Fleet is obviously doing the Zeppelin thing, and you know, there's Mix.
I don't love them live though.
I won't. They're coming on the show, so we'll wait till they come on. But I love them on record.
Yeah,
Definitely love them on record. I mean, I think there's, you know, Royal Blood was a very cool band that came out.
Yeah, forgot about that. Royal Blood's good.
But I feel like I don't know where they've been the last couple years. I mean, there's not a ton, you know. I mean, I guess we're all looking for the next GNR one day will ever happen. I don't really know if that
I hear there's a band called Rage Against the Machine that might be
coming
back soon.
Coachella. Are you going to Coachella? Do you do Coachella?
I haven't gone in years. I went to like the first like 11.
I was so disappointed by the last.
I'm sort of bummed by the dual weekend and like the amount of teens.
I mean, I like some of these
teens, but
yeah. Sometimes you go, there's like Bonnaroo and there's these, some of the other festivals. I find I like the eclectic mix that's going on there.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that you have like 90s hip hop and you'll have 80s rock and then you'll have alternative rock now.
Yeah.
And so that's cool. But yeah, Coachella's. It's been a bit all over the place the last couple of years. I can't say that I've been super inspired to go.
Super slammed. I mean, even if, you know, you've got hookups, like I usually get hookups, it's still like just really packed. I mean, I remember the first, you know, 8-9 years, it was you could breathe, you could run through a field and have a good time.
And my eyesight's going, Anthony. So when I walk through the field at like 9 at night, I can't see anything, and it's like I'm just like a blind person walking out there, and I see shadows, you know. So, but hey, man, this has been a lot of fun. We'll have to have you come back.
Sure.
I definitely think that you and Mick Fleetwood, I'll bring like some wine.
I'll tell you what to get. I know what he likes.
Maybe some cheese or something. I don't know, whatever. Yeah. And we'll do it again, bro. This is great. So follow Anthony, buy the Eminem book.
Yep.
And we'll see you guys next week with Perry Farrell. And after that, Jay Sheedy coming up.
Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
see you soon.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Our show today is brought to you by the fine folks at Thursday's Boot Company. You guys have seen me rocking these boots in every other picture I have on Instagram. I'm always repping them. Thursday's Boots is a bootstrap startup that makes the best handcrafted boots and sells them direct to consumer at some of the lowest markups in the footwear industry. Thursday's Boots tagline is highest quality, honest prices because they use some of the best materials like full grain leather, supple glove leather lining, and gold standard Goodyear welt construction. Thursday's Boot Company sells their boots at prices starting at just $149 with free shipping and returns. They've been featured in all the best fashion press, from Esquire to GQ to Cosmo and Vogue. And more importantly, they've gotten over 20,000 five-star reviews from real customers. Thursday's boots are perfect for people who understand quality and don't want to pay a high retail markup for a great-looking pair of boots that are built to last. So check them out at Thursday's Boots on Instagram. My favorite shoes, my favorite boots. You always see me repping them. And so the show will return next week, and have a great week, guys.
Hi, I'm Jingle Jared. In my former occupation, I was the biggest jingle writer of all time. Now, I'm looking for a new job, speaking to every entrepreneur that I can find so I can find out what it's like to transition from one career to another. All of this expert advice has become the bedrock for a podcast I'm calling Occupational Therapy. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Ooh, la, la.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here, and I want to tell you about the Orange Tree. Now, I have recently started a podcast network called Audio Up, and much as I prepare for movie roles, I've been researching the podcast landscape and listening to hundreds of podcasts. One in particular stopped me in my tracks. The Orange Tree. It's a true crime podcast series told with such authenticity and care by Haley Butler and Tinu Thomas, two journalists who were University of Texas students when they started reporting on the story. It's about the 2005 murder of a young woman named Jennifer Cave near the University of Texas at Austin campus. What struck me most was the thorough examination of the case and the exclusive access granted to these two young reporters. What makes this true crime story so unique is their perspective. They're two young women who are the same age as Jennifer Cave and at very similar points in their lives. The Orange Tree is engaging, it's thoughtful, and really, really powerful. Take a listen to The Orange Tree on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts today.